You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev. Anne and Kev actually in the same studio, which hasn't happened for quite some time. How are you, Anne?
I'm good. Hello, dear listener. And yes, it is true. It's just like riding a bicycle, isn't it, Kevin?
Well, sort of. I was beginning to think, Kyle and Jackie O have had this massive falling out and they're about to blow their $100 million contract over 10 years, et cetera. I thought we might be in similar waters. I don't know. I've been feeling a reluctance, Anne, of you coming back into the studio. I think you've been out for quite some time. You've become comfortable in the outside world.
I did.
I was wondering whether we could get you back again. Are we going to have to renegotiate the contract? What's going on?
Yes. I want double of nothing. Yes. I did have a nice long break. Thanks for holding things down here while I was gone.
Yeah, well, had to be done, as they say. Hey, whilst you were away, I was going over MMT 101.
I did hear some of that.
Yeah, so we started with, where does money come from? And the conclusion we came to, when I say we, I mean me, the conclusion that I came to after extensive analysis of the economy, with a fair few academics guiding the way for me, I discovered that all money comes from the government. Even banking eventually comes back to government money. There's no Australian dollars that aren't produced by the Australian government eventually. So the government spends into the economy.
Yes.
And when it pays the army, that's new money entering the economy. And banking time shifts spending decisions for people who eventually have to acquire that money through the economy when the government spends into it. So that's just time shifting of spending decisions. So we understand now. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just bringing you up to speed.
Oh, thank you. This helps me.
Because you haven't been here for a while. The listeners are all up to speed. Everybody else is up to speed. I'm just letting you know what we've been discovering in your absence.
Uh-huh. Appreciate it, Kevin.
So we discovered that all money mm-hmm. comes from the government. And when the government spends, it adds to the money supply in the private sector. But this week we're talking about taxation.
Well, I guess if we figured out that the government is not borrowing off rich people when it spends, then it's also not taxing us as income.
Well,
I guess that's the spoiler.
Well, I'm going to say this right from the start. Mm. If the government spends into the economy, it adds money to the economy, right? And when we talk about the economy, we're essentially talking about the private sector or the non-government sector, because the government doesn't need money. It creates the money, so it doesn't need money, right? Mm. It supplies money into the economy by spending and with its arrangement with the banks so that people can lend. When it taxes, it takes money out of the economy. I was having a discussion with my mate Flip about this the other day. And he's an accountant. He's good with numbers. He's really good with numbers. And he's going, but what are you talking about? And I'm saying, well, the ledger, mate, is the money that people in the community have to spend. And when the government spends into the economy, it creates more money for people to access. And when it taxes, it takes it out. That money is extinguished. And he says, you can't say extinguished. And I'm going, yes, I can, because it's taken off the ledger. Mm. That means that money is no longer in circulation and able to be used. It's gone.
Doesn't go anywhere else.
Okay, so when we're talking about taxation, we're talking about extinguishing money, taking money out of the economy, not to be used anymore. See you later. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's it.
Yes. It's funny, isn't it? Even accountants cannot get their heads around it because it's been so drummed into us that the government needs the taxes in order to spend.
Yeah, well, his starting point was like, well, you got to pay it back. And I'm going, no, because they didn't borrow it. They invented it. They created it. It came from nothing. So there's no debt.
And that taxing and spending is what the economists call fiscal policy. That's the fiscal side. Anytime you hear them talking about that in the media, that means the taxing and the spending that the federal government is doing.
Yeah, so whenever we speak about taxation, just get this in your head that I'm talking to me. I did this show a while ago, Wagarama, and one of the bouncers was, you've got to get it into your head, mate. You've got to get it into your head. And so this is me speaking to me. I've got to get it into my head. When I hear the word taxation, all we're talking about is how the government extinguishes money. Like, why does it want to extinguish money? Why does it want to make money go away?
Well, that is the next question. Like, if it's not using the money as income, why does the government need to tax us?
Well, this is what today's show is about.
Okay, answering the big question.
Yep.
Okay, well, to help us explore this question, there was an event back on the 6th of September 2025, and that was an event on tax innovation held by the Queensland branch of the Australian Fabians. And at that event, two heterodox economists were speaking. That was economist Professor Bill Mitchell and Professor John Quiggin. I think we could start with John Quiggin's presentation.
Let's start with John. So we're talking about taxation. Mm-hmm. And the thing with these conversations is they're talking about all the nuances of how things should be taxed and what should be taxed. But just remember, taxation means money extinguished. Okay? John Quiggin.
So I'm going to some extent to pull a bit of a Swifty. I'm going to largely challenge the idea that what we need in tax policy is innovative ideas. And instead, I think, argue that what we primarily need is more courage in pursuing the ideas that are already available to us. Before spelling out more of the details on that, I'd just like to put some numbers out there because often this discussion is taking place in the absence of thinking about numbers, I always find it's very useful to have those numbers in mind so that we can tell when things are big or little numbers. Okay, if we raise $1 billion in taxation, is that a lot or a little? The answer is basically a little. So Australia's GDP, not the best measure of welfare, but the best measure of economic activity and taxable resources, is typically about $2.5 trillion a year, $2,500 billion. Of that, around 25%, a bit over $800 billion, is collected by the Commonwealth government in tax revenue. I'm going to focus pretty much on the Commonwealth in this talk. Now, that number has been fixed for a very long time and is seen in some sense as sacred, set back in the 1980s in the so-called trilogy commitments made by the Hawke government. Prior to that, the share of government in expenditure and revenue in national income or GDP had been rising fairly steadily, recognising the increasing demand for the kind of services that governments typically provide. One of them, university education, an expensive service, and one which has been increasingly needed as a larger proportion of the population attend either university or undertake post-secondary education. Similarly, the health sector has formed a larger sector of the economy than in the past, and that's primarily funded by governments. Most recently, over the last 10 years or so, we've had the National Disability Insurance Service, recognising that in the past we really haven't addressed the issue of Australians with disabilities in any systematic way. We've tried more or less continuously to deliver those increased services without increasing the ratio of tax to GDP. And I'm going to argue that that's really an endeavour that can't be sustained. I've given dollar figures here, but I'm very much focused not on the financial accounting of budget deficit and so forth. As I think Bill will explain, the measures like the budget deficit are just residuals that drop out when you've determined what governments need to do and what they need to take out of the economy in order to make room for governments to do the things they have to. So when we look at increase in the revenue available to governments to deliver services. We're talking about acquiring real resources from the economy. Those real resources, most of the time, have to be taken out of the consumption or other expenditure of people in the community, and most importantly, those on high incomes. So what does this suggest where we should be looking? The first thing, as I said, we're looking at an economy of $2,500 billion worth of output a year. 1% of that is $25 billion. We really need to increase the share of the national economy being delivered by the federal government by several percentage points if we're going to meet the needs of a modern society. And so when we start looking at the kinds of options that are available, I'm going to list some of the biggest amounts, some of the biggest areas that come to roughly this 1% of GDP. And we'll see, I think, why this proves difficult. Well, the first one a lot of people talk about, and I'm going to dismiss pretty quickly, is the GST. Lots of countries have a higher rate of GST than we do. And most countries have pretty much the same range of exemptions as we do. But when we look at the way the GST was introduced, it's tied up so tightly by the legislation that brought it into effect that an increase is effectively impossible. All the states have to agree to an increase in the rate, and of course none of them are going to agree until they've got their share of the cake, and their demands will add up to considerably more than the additional revenue. In absolute principle, a Commonwealth government with a compliant Senate could repeal that legislation, do the states over and say we're just going to increase the rate of GST and keep the money. I don't see that as a realistic possibility. So we have a large share of taxation that essentially can't be addressed or changed in any way. But the big one is income tax. And there's a huge amount of room to get extra revenue from income tax. The part of the changes that came about at the time of the Hawke-Keating government and the trilogy were reductions in the top marginal tax rate from up to 66% under the Fraser government down to current levels of 47 or 48%. So the simplest, but of course not easiest way of getting an extra 1% of GDP would be to return the top marginal tax rate on incomes above $180,000 a year, return that to 60%. That'd be an entirely reasonable thing to do. We don't need any innovation. It's indeed the reversal of a previous innovation. What we need is the willingness to say, as a society, we need more and better services, and the people who should give up consumption for those services are the people who already have very high levels of consumption, and namely those on very high incomes. Most of the remaining big areas are not found in the explicit part of the tax system, but in what's called tax expenditures. And these are concessions on tax that are provided relative to a situation where the taxes in question were applied across the board. The big ones are in the superannuation system. We have an incredibly complex range of concessions for superannuation, which have been variously added to as political bribes at various points and then reined back. So there's another couple of percentage points of GDP going into concessions for superannuation that could be wound back quite a lot. We have, of course, the various interventions in the housing market, all of which have the effect of increasing the price of houses. And again, we can see the politics of this very clearly. There's a lot of people who own houses who want to see the value of those houses rise. Governments find it much easier to pump up demand, as the current government's doing with various half-baked schemes, than to do anything which would actually reduce the price of housing, even if the result would be to produce additional revenue. And so, of course, the big example here is negative gearing, full deductibility of interest. That wouldn't matter if we had a full capital gains tax. So the reason negative gearing works is that you can deduct the interest on a rental house. When you sell the house, the appreciation in the value of the house, only half of that is taxable. So that's a very large area of concessional treatment that, again, produces large effects in terms of the amount of revenue foregone. Finally, the exemption of the family home from capital gains tax. We've become a society in which essentially ownership of either your own large home or multiple homes has become the principal investment vehicle. That's an incredibly problematic situation. The incentives are all there. I think most of us have seen those incentives, but at some point we need to wind them back. So I think we also, I guess, need to look after that at the taxation of capital. And again, what we've seen under the influence of neoliberalism is a belief that taxation of capital should really not be undertaken, that anything we do that reduces returns to capital is going to produce an outflow of capital from this country. That, I think, doesn't stand up to scrutiny. We see that that we've managed substantially higher rates of return on taxation of corporate profits in the past without significantly affecting investment. And of course, we have the option of increasing public investments in any areas where private investment falls short. So we really know what we need to do about taxation. We don't need fundamentally new ideas in terms of the taxes we levy. We need to understand, I think, that there are no easy solutions. We can, of course, help ourselves a little bit by getting away from obsessions with things like budget deficits, which I'm sure Bill will tell you something about. But we can't ultimately get away from the fact that most of what we spend on providing services, most of the resources we use to provide public services, those resources have to be taken from someone. And the way to take those resources is through taxation. We've done this in the past and we need to keep on doing it.
Yeah, listen, people, listen.
Was Australian economist John Quiggin, who is a professor of economics at the University of Queensland, and he was speaking at an event hosted by the Queensland branch of the Australian Fabians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know the thing that he said that most interested me, which is not directly a tax thing, but he mentioned this trilogy commitment. So he was saying that the past Prime Minister of Australia, Bob Hawke, made this trilogy commitment, which hadn't really registered with me before, so I had to go and look it up.
Sure.
And I feel like this is the source of what we would call a voluntary constraint on government spending, and one that apparently Labor's upholding to this day. So when I had a look online, this trilogy commitment was a set of election promises that Bob Hawke made in the lead-up to the federal election of 1984. Mm-hmm. And these three promises were, one, the overall level of taxation will not increase as a proportion of GDP, that the deficit will not increase as a proportion of GDP, and three, that government spending increases will be restrained below the rate of economic growth. Now, coming up in this episode, we'll hear Bill Mitchell say that these ratios, this tax to GDP, this deficit to GDP, and this spending to GDP growth, they are all meaningless without context. And I'm not even sure that the government can really control any of these ratios. So I'm thinking that back in 1984, this is showing the rightward swing of Labor. And I guess Hawke back then was trying to head off the old criticism that, you know, Labor is bad economic managers. But effectively what Hawke's doing here is he is voluntarily shackling himself with this neoliberal economic thinking and trapping Labor within the framing that the federal government needs to watch its spending in the same way that a household does. And when you put these constraints on the federal government, what you're effectively doing is you are allowing the private sector to have first dibs on all our collective wealth, because you're saying they need to do the spending. And also, you're making a great excuse for why you need to give tax cuts to the high earners.
So I'm going to go back to what I said originally at the beginning of the program. When we're talking about taxation, we're talking about money being extinguished, removed, from the economy. It goes in when they spend, it goes out when it's taxed.
Mm.
So the whole notion that we need taxation to cover this expenditure of the government becomes irrational. And what we see here is a Labor government dancing to the tune of neoliberalism, which gives this misinformed view that governments are constrained by their tax revenue. So herein lies the problem for us. Like, we know that that's not true, but the rest of the world doesn't.
No.
Most of the world doesn't. The orthodox economists and governments around the world think that they're constrained by this. Like, if we just say to them, you guys, you're wrong, and stop doing it, that ain't going to work, right? They're going to go, you're nuts, and they're nuts, not us. We understand how this works. And it must be very difficult for people like John Quiggin and Bill Mitchell to have these conversations, because it's like you're talking to a bunch of people who are possessed, you know, with misinformation. And you know, this is a human characteristic. Belief is stronger than facts. We know this.
Unfortunately true. I wonder if we handed every person on NDIS a pitchfork that says the Australian federal government cannot run out of money funding the NDIS. Maybe that would help.
Everybody's dancing this tune saying we've got to destroy and remove this amount of the money to satisfy this this misinformed belief that it pays for government spending, and we can't help people with disabilities unless we destroy money to the tune that we're going to help them. It's irrational, it's insane, and it's frustrating when you understand how these things work.
On that issue of destroying the money, I had a hard time getting my head around it, because I do like to recycle my bottles and my newspapers. And I used to think, why can't they just recycle the money?
Well, yeah, if it was all notes, yes, that would be the case. And you know, like anybody who's studied the economy of the USA before they had a unified
dollar system,
Each state had their own currency, and they used to incinerate. They used to literally destroy the notes that were returned in taxation so that they couldn't be used again, because if they could be recycled, that would be amount to counterfeiting, and they needed to get rid of them. You know,
so, the proof is in the pudding there, isn't it, when they used to actually burn their money.
Yeah.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
Shall we talk about why we do need to tax?
Let's do it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Well, the four main reasons for why we actually do need to tax, if the government does not need the tax as income. There is the fundamental reason for taxing, which comes back to the origins of money story that you've already covered, which is that is how the federal government will create the desire in the population for the currency. So if somebody somewhere in the population has to pay fees, fines or taxes in Australian dollars, then you will be happy to earn Australian dollars, because you know someone else in the economy is always going to accept them in payment.
I always have to sort of go over this one in my head, because it doesn't make automatic sense. So the government spends into the economy and it taxes back, but you can only pay it in Australian dollars. So you have to earn Australian dollars to pay the tax that is going to come your way. And if you don't, you go to jail. So that's a way of saying use Australian dollars, don't use US dollars, don't use seashells, don't use Monopoly money. You have to use Australian dollars. You can use all those other things, but we will translate those into Australian dollars and ask you to pay tax in it.
That's right. And we do want to change behaviour. So my favourite one at the moment is the prohibition effectively on tobacco and cigarettes that has changed behaviour such that we now have a fantastic black market.
Black market, yeah.
So there we have incentivised our gangs.
Well, there you have taxation without regulation. You can whack a tax on the cigarettes, but unless you're prepared to back it up with enforcement, you'll just open up a black market, and that's what's happened.
That's true. Yeah. The other one is that we can use taxes to redistribute wealth. In other words, rebalance where the wealth is. So if it's pooling up one end of town, as it tends to do, by deliberate policy that's been enacted, as John Quiggin was talking about, capital gains and the negative gearing.
Yep.
So those have combined to shift wealth in the form of housing into one section of the population.
And, of course, that distorts market prices, because now house prices are inflated beyond nearly everything else. Mm. That creates a distortion in the market. Mm. This has happened in my lifetime. I could afford a house back in 1992 when I was looking for one, when I was an AV technician and my partner was a youth worker. Housing was affordable back then, as it had been for decades beforehand.
Mm. And that was due to deliberate policy as well.
Yeah, and it was the policies of governments that favoured investors that have now pushed those prices out of reach of ordinary workers. And so we can see here, if you had a tax policy that was properly applied, it would push down house prices and you would remove this distortion from the market. Mm, very important.
I think taxing is like a tool that a sculptor would use to shape the economy.
Yep.
And then the last one is what the modern monetary theory economists call creating the resource space for the government to spend into. So that's the big one for why we tax. And what does that really mean? Well, it means that if you tax individuals or companies, what you're doing is you're taking away some of their money, and that means you're taking away some of their ability to spend, and that means they won't be buying so much stuff, which means that this stuff then becomes available for the government to buy and use. So, for example, if you're the government and you want to build a fast train between Melbourne and Sydney, you might want to tax the people that want to use that steel and concrete and labour to build ballrooms on the top of skyscrapers.
Yes, or next to a White House if you're in America.
That's right. Yep. Or if you want to build public housing, you might tax those people who want to build their third or fourth mansion.
Yeah, you know, there is an enormous amount of disproportionate resources used for the wealthy to build their playthings, their McMansions and multiple properties, etc. You know, at the same time that we have a supposed shortage of availability to build public housing, you still see plenty of places being renovated when you drive along Beach Road, along Port Phillip Bay. Some of these beachfront properties, they never stop being ripped down and put back up again, etc. There's no shortage of resources for them there.
No.
So tax those mongrels and free up those resources for better use.
And, you know, people often think that modern monetary theory is saying use taxation to fight inflation, as in to stop a bidding war between the government and the private sector when there aren't many resources. Yet MMT economists are on the record as saying that relying on the federal government to raise or lower taxes to fine-tune the economy, that wouldn't succeed. And I'm thinking, why are people getting mixed up around this? And I think there's a very subtle distinction here, which is that you need to understand the difference between a functional description of taxes. So the way the economy functions, yes, taxing creates the resource space, which stops inflation. But then there's a difference between that and the policy implementation of taxing. And so, unfortunately, we do not live in a world where you can just run around taxing things at the last minute to stop inflation.
Mm, yeah. All very interesting. I think we should have a quick break and go straight into Bill Mitchell's input at that very same Fabian event, which was in Queensland some time ago.
Yeah, listen, people, listen.
I just ducked out of another meeting on climate change where I'm talking later, and all the talk there is carbon taxes, and I'll come back to that. I'm not a supporter. So thank you, and I just reject the premise of this workshop in the best spirit, of course. And what I mean by that is that the premise that was outlined in the correspondence to me prior to the meeting, that we're really looking to provide more funds for the government. And typically we're thinking federal government here rather than state, I believe, even though the state governments under our constitution have the large expenditure responsibilities in the policy areas, which is an aberration and really a defect of the constitution, which historically reflected the suspicion of the various colonial entities that became Australia. And I'm not suggesting that we have a hope in hell of reforming, you know, the horizontal inequity and the vertical inequity. And even though when Rudd was in Prime Minister, he did attempt to
partially take over health funding and failed effectively. So the point I'm making, and John really made it really well, that what progressive people have to stop thinking about is the monetary side of this issue. And what John said was that if we want the government to be larger, and most progressives that I know here and everywhere else do want the public sector to have a larger footprint on the economy, which means that it commands more real resources than the non-government sector. And at any point in time, the resources are finite. So a larger government means that the non-government sector has less productive resources. We're not talking about money here. We're talking about real productive resources, labour, capital, land, environment. And I underline environment because the mainstream of my profession effectively ignores the environment as a productive resource. And that's why we have such significant challenges ahead. But if we want a larger government, which is the implicit notion of this workshop, then what we're saying is not that we want it to have more money, but we want it to have more resources at its command. And I think it's really important that the left, and I'll use left as a generic for progressiveness, even though we've been severely let down by a lot of leftists not being progressive. But if we want more government, then we've got to work out a way in which we have less non-government sector. So John said I'd tell you about budget deficits. I don't even use the word budget because, again, the framing is misleading, because budgets apply to, I've got a budget, even though I'm not very good at it, I've got a budget because I have a financial constraint. I have to go to work to get income, or draw down prior savings, or borrow if I want to spend more than my current available income. And that means I've got a budget. A budget implies you've got a financial constraint. The federal government hasn't any financial constraint. It has infinity minus 1 cent Australian dollars available to it. And so we shouldn't talk about taxation in terms of providing more monetary funds to the government in order to spend. And when we appraise the fiscal position of the government, we should forget all of the standard ratios that are pumped out by commentators and treasury statements and central banks and all the rest of it, and economists, because they're basically misleading. You know, a 2% deficit to GDP, is that better than a 10% deficit? Well, we've all been conditioned to say yes. And a 4% surplus is better than a 2% deficit. We've all been conditioned into believing that to be the case. But without a context, we can't make any statement about that. A 10% deficit to GDP might be perfectly appropriate, as a 4% surplus might be perfectly appropriate. It all depends upon the context. And the context is the available real resources and the command on those resources of both the non-government and the government sector. And of course, if you've got idle real resources, and we have that in Australia at the moment in general terms, you know, the broad labour underutilisation rate's currently, what, about 10.1%. That means that 10.1% of available resources minus a small number for the frictions moving between jobs are underutilised in one way or other. So it would be very difficult for us to mount a case we're close to full capacity. And so if we're not close to full capacity, then the size of the fiscal deficit of the federal government is too small. That's where I come from. And therefore, we can accommodate a situation where we want more spending and we don't have to worry about real resource offsets to to produce that in general. Now, if we get to a scenario where we've got full capacity, and that is that the nominal spending in society is such that it's coming up against the ceiling of the productive side of the economy to produce real goods and services in response, well, then we've got a question to ask. If we want the government to be larger as a commitment to progressive policies, then we can do that in two ways. One way we could do it would be the government just to start spending more money, in other words, increase nominal spending. And the government could certainly go into the labour market, for example, and compete for skilled resources and pay more for them and attract them to the public sector. And we've seen that in recent years in the construction industry with the large state government infrastructure projects in Melbourne and Sydney, where you've now got carpenters being drawn from regional areas of Victoria into the city, and they've become lollipop men on the major construction sites at very high pay and not even using their carpentry skills. And in the regions, the small-scale construction firms can't get carpenters anymore. So we have seen elements of that sort of thing I'm talking about. But in general, the government could compete with the non-government sector for resources if we're at full capacity. And all it'll do is have a bidding war at market prices. And that's what we call inflation. And I've never advocated that. So the second way we can do it to expand the government sector if we're at full capacity is to reduce the non-government sector. And there are a number of ways we can do it. We could do it by dictate. We tend not to do that in this modern era. And the other important way we can do it is through taxation. And here's the rub, that the taxation isn't to give the government any extra funds. It's got infinity minus a penny. The taxation is to take money off the non-government sector who would have otherwise spent that money and command real resources as a consequence. The taxation allows us to deprive the non-government sector of expenditure power. So in other words, we don't want more money for the public sector, we want less money for the non-government sector. That's the role, the way I do economics, of taxation. Humanity, humanity, humanity. Now, there's two other elements that are often poorly framed by progressives. One is this tax the rich scenario, and it makes us feel warm in heart that we're going to tax the rich in some way because we don't like them particularly. But it almost echoes Ayn Rand's famous narrative that the rest of us rely on the greatness of the productive entrepreneurs for our supper. In Atlas Shrugged, that was her narrative. And we've got to tax the rich so that we can have better healthcare or better education or public infrastructure, etc. Well, that's giving them too much importance. So then, do I want to tax the rich? Of course I do, because I want them to have less resources, but also in that context, I want them to have less political power. I want them to less be able to lobby governments and create think tanks and media companies and all the rest of it that distort the political debate and bias the political decisions in the favour of a few at the expense of the many. Humanity, humanity, humanity. And the second general framing issue is a lot of progressives fall into a very narrow perception of tax, and they say, oh, well, a broad-based tax, for example, like the GST, is bad because it's regressive. And that means that it's taking a higher tax on a person with a low income in proportion relative to someone with a higher income. And, you know, we don't really like regression, do we? Because it's antithetical to our notions of reducing inequality. But the thing I warn people about often when I'm talking about these issues is that when we're talking about regressivity or progressivity, we really should not be talking about individual components of the fiscal system. We should be appraising the fiscal system broadly, and that includes the expenditure side. So you could have a highly regressive tax side if it was achieving the goals that we desire to reduce the resource claim of the non-government sector, but at the same time you could have a excessively progressive expenditure side which balances out to be a progressive overall fiscal system. And I think when we're discussing fiscal policy, which is spending and taxing, then that's the way we should think about it rather than being obsessed with each single component. And remember, I'm thinking about the taxes are to reduce the claim on resources of the non-government sector. There are other reasons for taxes, of course, but the broad topic that I'm talking about today is that we want to create the fiscal space for governments to spend into, and that means claim resources without causing a bidding war at market prices. That's the task. So the sort of problems that I'm interested in are inequality, both within and across generations. It's creeping up in Australia. It's not as high as it is in other countries, but it's creeping up. And particularly, I think, we've got intergenerational inequality becoming quite a significant problem. And as John said, for most of us, the wealth that we can build up in our lives is in the form of housing. And even lower income people historically have been able to get a modicum of wealth to enjoy at the end of their working lives through home ownership. That means of equity is gone. The younger people are finding it extremely difficult to purchase homes, and moreover, that process is becoming biased to higher income and wealth families because of the bank of mum and dad, as it's called. Another major problem is that we're progressively getting degraded public infrastructure. One of the things that's very apparent is when governments run austerity, and you know, state governments have been running austerity for many years up until the recent infrastructure boom. But the way in which governments typically pursue austerity is to reduce capital expenditure because it's so hard to reduce consumption, recurrent consumption expenditure, because it shows up immediately and that gives governments political headaches. And so it's much easier just to cut spending on infrastructure. And that doesn't show up very quickly because, you know, there's depreciation, takes time, but eventually it starts showing up and we're starting to see those decaying effects. And of course, the other major problem we've got is climate change, and social change isn't going to be quick enough to meet the environmental shifts. That's my fear. We really need a huge reallocation of economic activity away from carbon intensive things. And how we're going to achieve that is much more significant government, federal government command resources than currently is the case. Humanity, humanity, humanity. So now we move to suggestions. Well, in general, we want efficient taxes, and efficient taxes are those that are easier and cheaper to collect. I take John's point on GST. It's going to be a very difficult tax ever to reform, but it should be broadened. And all of the things about all of the anomalies should be cleared up. But that's really small beer. I think I agree with John on that. And it really doesn't have significant tractions to the problems I just previously identified, particularly reducing the political power of the wealthy and reducing their command on resources. Negative gearing, I think we should abandon negative gearing. Keating I think, sold us a puppy when he said that it would destroy the rental market. I take the point that if we had an adequate capital gains policy, we wouldn't worry about negative gearing, but we don't. And I think negative gearing is easier to address than capital gains, both extremely difficult to address. On the concessional things John mentioned, I agree about having to do something about super. I mean, all the super concessions really favour those who have got the highest incomes during their working life and then the highest wealth, typically. I think there's a lot of road usage stuff that should be looked at, particularly the obsession in Australia with SUVs just creating havoc on road services and the environment. I don't support this current shift to taxing EVs. I think that's ridiculous. We should have more EVs, and any tax will reduce the incentive there. But that brings me to the three big ones. I think that we've got to look at land taxes in more detail, and particularly there's this notion of value capture, you know, being able to anticipate land rezoning and then make a mozza on it, and then make it very difficult for governments to come back in and provide public infrastructure at the higher land prices. That's got to be addressed. But the two other big things are, do we want a carbon tax? In general, we don't want to be dealing with the environmental challenge through the market. So I think the obsession with carbon taxes, which might be a short-run palliative, I believe more in rule-based regulation to achieve climate goals. And the last thing I'd say is the really new thing we should be looking at is wealth and inheritance taxes. I mean, we used to have death duties in this country. Bjelke Petersen forced all the other state governments to abandon them. There's massive inequities in the transmission of wealth in this country. And because wealth is relatively immobile in many cases, it's much easier to get the tax department to get their hands on. So I think the left should be thinking about wealth and inheritance taxes as a major new tax. And I agree with John to finish that we should be restoring the highest marginal tax bracket in the income tax system, much higher than it currently is. So I'll leave it there. Thank you. Yeah, listen, people, listen.
That was Professor Bill Mitchell, MMT economist, and he was reframing the discussion around tax innovation so that the rest of us stand a snowball's chance of understanding what on earth the role of taxation is. Yes. Context is everything, Kevin.
Context is everything. So what he's saying is just reduce the ability of the private sector to expand by taxing them, and then you open up space for the government to do projects which are important. Now, as you and I become more and more socialist, Anne, you know, let's not forget the basis of our society rests on socialism. Socialism is when things are owned by the state. So the more things that are owned by the state, the more socialist you are. The more things that are privatised, the more neoliberal you are. Mm-hmm. So our money is provided by the state. It's enforced by a legal system which is owned by the state. And so many of the foundations of our society are socialist. And then you can go into bridges and all that sort of stuff. So all we're talking about is increasing state initiatives by reducing the money that's available to the private sector by taxing them. That's what Bill's talking about there.
Yeah. So I agree with you there, Kevin, that I now think of money as a public utility, and what it does is it mobilises our collective wealth. So if you are telling the government it can't spend because it hasn't taxed enough, what you're saying is that you can't mobilise the collective wealth in the name of the public good, but, you know, the odd private enterprise can do it because they're the ones with the money or the ones that are able to spend.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with including private firms in the economy if they've got something to bring to it.
A mixed economy, I think, is what I'd be aiming for.
Yeah.
A private enterprise, but all the fundamentals I'd like to see being once again in the hands of a government. And you can see how difficult it is to talk about taxation without talking about the capacity of the federal government to spend, because, of course, that's what's under the surface of all this tax. And it was interesting to hear Bill mention about this issue of full capacity. So the upper limit, like how do you tell when your economy is at its full productive capacity? And what you do is you look at the unemployment rate, because the upper limit on capacity is how many people are around to do stuff. Once you run out of people, you can't do more stuff, right?
If there's people kicking around who are available to work, you're not at full capacity.
Mm.
So, and you know, you're never going to be at full capacity, but you want to be as close to it as you possibly and comfortably can be. There's always going to be some transient unemployment, people in between work, people who would like to work, but it's not convenient for them to work right now for whatever reason.
Yes. So the best description of full capacity would be 1 or 2% frictional unemployment, but everyone else who wants paid work is doing stuff to get that money.
Like it was from about 1945 to about 1970.
It can be done, and it was done.
Yeah, we're not talking theory here. We're talking about history. So,
So I was thinking about, as we were saying before, when you're talking about taxation, people usually jump immediately to talk about particular kinds of taxes. And what we're really doing is providing this overview from the MMT point of view about what is the role of taxes. So you understand why you're doing it before you jump in and go, well, we need to tax this and we need to tax that.
Yeah. So tax is not about funding government spending. It's a lever that the government can use. So the government spends into the economy to create money, and it then can use taxation as a lever to extract that money to affect various settings and change certain behaviours. That's all it's for.
I'd agree with that. And I mean, then you can start thinking about, if you're concerned about inequality or you're concerned about the environment and the biocapacity and shooting through planetary boundaries, then you can talk about, well, which kind of taxes would we want to do? For example, we could do a land tax. And the reason you would do that is to change behaviour in order to have an economy that's sustainable.
Yeah, we have this understanding of taxation in the economy, which is such a long way from the orthodoxy, that if we were to try and just land it on them, that'll freak out. So we've got to edge our way across to it. And there's one particular aspect to our taxation which has been bugging me. And this was before I even fully understood all of this. This became apparent to me. So I ran a business for a while. I'm still a sole trader with an ABN, etc. And when you're a business, it's your disposable income that's taxed. So you're taxed on your profit. So all of your expenses are deducted from taxation. So if I run a vehicle, I can tell you now my vehicle expenses come to about $10,000 or $11,000 per year. Half of that is fuel. The other half is tyres and servicing of the vehicle, etc. So if I earn money and then I claim that $10,000 or $11,000, that's tax deductible. So that $10,000 isn't taxed. Tools, work clothes, coffee on the job, catering, all that sort of stuff, you deduct it. If I was renting a premises, I'm not, but if I was, I could deduct the rent. I could deduct the energy bills, electricity, all that sort of stuff is deducted. And then after all my expenses have been removed, whatever is left over, that's what I get taxed on. That's what applies to businesses. What I don't understand is why that doesn't apply to private citizens. Because if you're being taxed on your disposable income, if you're a PAYG employee, you're taxed on your gross income. There's a couple of things you can deduct, but they're far and few between. Why can't PAYG ordinary workers deduct their overheads, like their rent, their electricity bills? These are all the things that they need to exist and provide a service as a worker. Why aren't workers allowed to deduct all of their expenses like businesses are? Now, there's a rationale which favours one group over the other, which seems to be unfair. So if we wanted to incrementally come across and you wanted to take the tax burden off ordinary workers, which is where it's landed, because if you believe the misinformed view that taxation covers government spending, then as you decrease the tax rates for the wealthy, when you drop it from the 67% that it was down to the rate that it is now, it falls onto ordinary workers to make up that difference. It shouldn't, but that's how it's done. So the idea of dropping income tax for ordinary workers is something which politicians shy away from because it's such a large part of their tax, I'm not going to use the word revenue, their tax take.
You can use the word revenue. It sounds like income, but all it means is returning the money to the government from whence it came.
Yeah, so if you've got this misinformed view that you need to balance expenditure with your tax take, that burden has been falling increasingly on workers as the neoliberal agenda has been relieving those with wealth to pay tax. And it seems to me to be hypocritical. And workers of the world should be annoyed by this. I certainly was, even before I understood all the other tax implications. So there would be, a way of skewing the tax debate in its current misinformed view to put the burden back on those with wealth and away from those who are just ordinary workers. Mm. Just be taxed on your disposable income. What you've got left after all of your expenses, that's what you should be taxed on, for workers and for businesses. So if that simple message could strike a chord somewhere, which might sit better with people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, taxing the top end of town, as they say, taxing the really wealthy, there's so many reasons to do that. And it's because you do want to lower their consumption. And that fits in with a degrowth agenda, which is how are we going to survive as a civilization. And I was hearing that these big sort of mega cruise things that they run around, go sailing off in, even when they're just sitting in dry dock, they're using all this carbon, right, in the maintenance.
Generators are ticking over just to keep the lights on, just to keep the fridges running, the fridges with the champagne, et cetera. And, it's obscene. Mm. The other thing is that if you look at any society, the flatter that society, the happier there is. It doesn't matter how your lowest income earners are. If there seems to be a huge gap between them and others and it's in your face, it creates disquiet.
Well, more than disquiet. So that's taxation's function to redistribute wealth to keep a more even playing field. And there are some fantastic studies. We could even do a whole episode on this, which is to show how levels of inequality are way more important and correlate with all the ills of society, everything from low educational attainments, infant mortality rates, all of those things. They actually don't depend on the total income or GDP of the country. They depend on the disparity of wealth.
Yeah, indeed. We're getting towards the end of the show here.
Where are we heading next?
Well, after this, we're heading to the pub. We're going to Goldie's in Collingwood.
Yes.
That's where we're heading tonight. After this one. Tonight, on Friday, we've got this public money, public good pub meets happening in Melbourne, Canberra and Sydney. Simultaneously.
Yeah, if you want to be alerted to those, public money, public good. .net. In the meantime.
Yep, we've got to go. Mafalda's up next. Good to have you back on the airwaves.
Yeah, nice to see you in person again, Kev.
And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. See you later.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage or the quantity theory of money or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to... bring the economists in, we're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.